Good evening. You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm going to hand it over to Annie to get things going.
You are still listening to KFAI 90.3 AM and streaming live on the radio at kfai.org on the web. Ooh, I'm Annie Harvey, clearly in my right mind. Tonight, Dave Fettig chats with Chris Stark, author of the Minnesota Book Award-nominated novel Carnival Lights. Set in a summer of hippie Vietnam War protests and the moon landing, Carnival Lights also spans settler arrival in the 1800s, the creation of the reservation system, and decades of cultural suppression. Chris teaches at Central Lakes Community College in Brainerd, Minnesota, and she is a member of the Minnesota Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force.
And I'm Dave Fettig. Then, in the last part of the hour, Liz Olds talks with Carol Lawrence, an award-winning novelist, poet, composer, and playwright. A journalist in 19th century New York matches wits with a serial killer in a gripping thriller by the prize-winning author of the Ian Hamilton Mysteries. Lawrence has received several awards, including the Euphoria Poetry Prize and the Eve of St. Agnes Poetry Prize. She's a Hawthornden Fellow and has taught at NYU and the Gotham Writers Workshop, among her many teaching credits. All of this and so much more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. And now this. Arrest you, pick you up, do whatever they wanted with you.
I think that's...
Hi, Chris, and welcome to Right on Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you here and to talk about your new novel, Carnival Lights. And I want to mention to our listeners that the novel has been nominated for a Minnesota Book Award, and that event will happen next Tuesday evening. So good luck, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. It's really exciting.
Well, it's a novel that's worthy of it, and we wish you all the best. And I look forward to talking to you about it. But let's get started at the top with a reading, if you would, please. And before we do that, if you could tell us about the book, the scope of it, and then set up the reading for us, and then we'll dig in.
Sure. It's technically historical fiction. It follows two Ojibwe teen girl cousins, Cher and Chris, over the course of a few weeks in August of 1969. But the backstory digs into their family going back into the 1800s and then up through 1969. And there's actual historical events and characters who also are woven in throughout the fictional story of the Ojibwe family and the two Ojibwe girls. So it's all set in Minnesota, and I'm just really thrilled. I started it 20 years ago. The two characters came to me 20 years ago, and I'm quite thrilled to have finished it and then be up for a Minnesota Book Award.
Yeah, tremendous. Wonderful. So set our reading up for us, if you would, please.
Absolutely. So this picks up with the girls after they have left the fictitious Northern Minnesota Reservation, come down to Minneapolis on a Greyhound bus, again in August 1969. And shortly after getting off the bus, they're approached by two men, kind of playing a good cop, bad cop with the girls. And they don't immediately understand what is going on, but once they do, they take off running. And that's where this part of the book picks up. The girls ran. The pack slapped against Cher's back. "In here." Cher yanked Chris down a narrow brick alley. A cat ran off. Cher cut behind some garbage cans, lost her footing, and slid into a pile of bulky garbage bags. Kristen tumbled behind her. The girls froze like the statue game they used to play. The alley smelled like fish and sour milk. Footsteps approached. Cher peered between the cans and reached back reflexively to touch Chris's lips. The well-dressed man stopped at the alley and then continued down the sidewalk, away from the depot. Cher watched the street, and Chris watched her, keeping her head low. The girls did not move. A man trotted by, coming from the direction of the bus depot. Cher thought, but could not be sure, that it was the first man, the one with the shiny shoes, half running because he could not lift his feet up high enough or fast enough without slipping. After he passed the alley, Cher looked at Kristen and lifted her eyebrows as if to say, "Who knows?" When the girls were babies, their grandmother had pinched their lips to teach them silence. The girls knew how to be still, not make any sound, thoughtful even of their breathing, until their grandmother found them flat on the floor beneath the homemade horsehair stuffed mattress or under the workshop in the basement over which their grandmother had draped an old wool blanket to hide them from the white lady social workers who came looking to steal Indian children. When older, if the girls were out in the yard and heard a car different than the rattle of their grandparents' truck, they'd run to the house or barn or shed. If in the fields, the girls stood stock still in line with the corn rows or dove into an indentation in the earth, where they stayed until the bell on the porch rang four times. Their grandmother only dyed their homespun clothes earth colors, leaving behind the brightly beaded and dyed regalia of the Ojibwe to make sure her babies did not pop out of the browns and greens like red choke cherries before they ripened into a purple mass hanging heavy off a branch. If in the house when a car drove up unannounced, their grandmother commanded, "Down." The girls ran, slid, and ducked into their hiding holes, listening, breathing without sound, always waiting for the bell four times. Ethel's granddaughters were not going to disappear into the white world as she had, stolen from her family and placed in a Catholic boarding school, and then sold to work as a domestic on a farm outside Fargo. 2 months after being dropped off by the nuns and daily beatings by the farm wife with a broomstick and rolling pin, she ran away, finally escaping for good down unknown back roads. The girls stayed in the alley for some time, occasionally glancing behind them where the alley dogleg to the right. A silence rose up, split by sirens and the squeals of wheels. No bell rang four times so they could come out of hiding, bury themselves in their grandmother's belly and fleshy arms. Cher glanced from the street to the alley behind them and then back again. Her knee and shin swelled from the crash into the bags. Anxiety surfaced in Chris, popping like welts over her body. She rested her head on Cher's calf. Cher smoothed her cousin's hair and kept watch, breathing through her mouth to minimize the smell, wanting to spit, but afraid of the noise that would make. Time stilled, the moon edged west. Cher thought of the story about how time was brought to Indians by a big clock. She could see her grandfather telling the story again, his skinny brown legs jutting out of his shorts and off the upside down bucket he sat on. "Since then," he said, his eyes shining with that light that popped when he told stories, "Indians have been weighted down." He pulled on an imaginary chain around his neck, just like the white man, by that tick-tock time machine. The number of cars on the street lessened. Muffled voices, sirens, and laughing drifted down the alley. Cher shifted, found another crack she could peer through, and then locked her body in that position. Chris moved with her. Two men's voices neared. The depot men stopped and looked down the alley. "Look down there?" "Oh, no need," the well-dressed man said. "I would have seen them turn into it." The man with the shiny shoes stared down the alley. "They're gone, for now. One's Indian, maybe both. We'll find them. Can't hide on these streets forever."
Thank you. That was Chris Stark reading from her new novel, Carnival Lights. And that gives you listeners a sense for the drama, the journey of Chris and Cher, and indeed even their ancestors. There's a lot packed into that reading. Thank you for that, Chris.
Yeah, thank you.
We need to talk a lot about Chris and Cher, but before we do, where did this story come from?
It actually began when I was living in Florida and going to graduate school at the University of Central Florida. We had an assignment to do an imitation of Cormac McCarthy's All the Pretty Horses. And Cher and Chris just popped out in that 7-page imitation. Huh. My instructor said afterwards, "I really hope that you write these girls' stories because you have a responsibility to them." So that's where it began. And that was 20 years ago, a long time ago.
Wow. Wow. I can see why you can't write this in a hurry. So we're going to talk about Chris and Cher a lot and maybe come back to them. But so let's start with them. Where did these, another sort of formative question, Chris. Chris, this is Chris with a K. You're Chris with a C-H. But Chris, where did Chris with a K and Cher, where did they come from? They're just two captivating characters. We care so much about them. And you broke our hearts with them and made us love them. But where did they come from when you had that experience down in Florida?
It's interesting because I feel like they emerged, they introduced themselves to me in that little bit of imitation writing. And most of those 7 or 10 pages appeared in the book exactly the way that it was written then.
Oh, wow.
So that was really the core of the seed of the story, those two girls. And then that little section there that I began with. So my experience in writing them and much of this book is as much as listening to these characters that emerge or mm-hmm. sort of come to me versus me really thinking, oh, I'm making this up on this person based on this person and another person. So it's almost like a co-creation. Of course, I'm the writer, but it almost feels like more, you know, more of a co-creation with whatever you want to call it, creativity, the spirituality, imagination.
Right. No, that's interesting. That makes sense. Chris and Cher are related. They're cousins. They make a decision to leave the reservation. And then they go off on, they're always running, Chris, running from something. What are they running toward? They're not even sure themselves, are they?
Yeah, I don't think so. They're running towards themselves, but they don't know where that's going to take them and where they're going to or what they're going to become. Cher is more self-realized than Chris is. Chris went through some difficult things in her childhood.
Yes.
And Cher has a steadiness about her. And Chris is much more on fire and flighty than Cher because of that abuse, because of that past. And that was one of the things that I wanted to show, you know, with the two of them as well, just sort of that contrast and the difference that it can make for young people and the trajectory of their lives going forward when they have experienced difficult times, the kind of toll that can take on a teenager.
Yeah. They're often in danger of being caught. The sense of being on the run is very powerful sort of theme and idea. And I know it's a part of the story, but it also works as a progressive theme, at least for me as a reader. Can you tell us a little bit about that time, 1969, if you were a young person, young women, girls, Native girls, on the run, if you will, in Minnesota. Was that a particular feature of the time? And I say feature in quotes, such that if you were out, if you're riding on a bus, if you were alone in the city, you were naturally presumed to be some sort of truant, and men, and it was always men, of course, could arrest you, pick you up, do whatever they wanted with you.
I think that's very true for girls at that time. And I think it continues to be sadly all too true for girls at this time. And in terms of Native girls, when you look at the history of, as my Wet'en, I'm Ojibwe and Cherokee, my Wet'en Earl Hoagland always said, the attempted genocide, because we're still here, you know, that's a long history of survival, resistance, running, in some ways being hunted as well. And that's, you know, one of the sort of minor, I guess, themes or more subtle themes that goes along with that aspect of running is being hunted. And, you know, when you read the history books, that's a dominant theme for many Native people, running, hiding, assimilating. You know, if you end up with, you know, facial features and skin that can pass, you might pass right into the white world and disappear right into the white world. You know, that happened to a lot of people as well.
Yes.
So there's all sorts of ways to run and hide. And these girls set off to hopefully find a better future for themselves, but they're not prepared. They're not prepared for what is waiting for them.
One of the girls could pass as white, it seems. Mm-hmm. Chooses not to, I suppose, or chooses to stick with her cousin, which by aligning herself with her cousin, she puts herself at risk. It's a sad statement of the times, I guess, in the time that mere association would put her in danger, association with family.
Yeah. And like I said, my elders talk about that. Even my grandmother's age, which wasn't all that long ago, however you looked, if you quote unquote look Native, or if you could pass as white, if the people would find out that you were Native, you could be raped, murdered, lose your land, lose your children, and I think a lot of people are not aware of not only what is happening, now to a lot of Native people with the MMIW and MMIR, but how intense and how heavy that was. And you listen to those elder stories, and it really gives you a different version of history for this country. And that is definitely something that I drew upon in writing this book, was the things that the elders passed along to me in their stories. I didn't use their exact stories, right, but the general themes definitely show up in this book. Yeah.
You mentioned MMIW, MMIR. Do you want to describe those?
Yeah. So people may have heard of missing and murdered Indigenous women, or missing and murdered Indigenous relatives.
Yep.
And some great news here, going off the literary path a little bit.
Good.
I was on the Minnesota MMIW task force, and we now have the first ever MMIR. They changed it to relatives to be more inclusive. MMIR, legislatively mandated office here in Minnesota to help to address these issues that have been ongoing since contact. So we have a lot of MMIR, missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, right now, in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And it's really an exciting time because there's work being done and there's organizing being done around those issues to help prevent that, and also to help find those relatives who have been murdered or lost.
Thank you for that bit of hopeful news.
Yeah.
We will take it with a grain of salt, but it's hope. And it's some movement, and especially coming off of your novel, which I, as I said, left me somewhat heartbroken. The history that pops in here, and I'm going to start repeating myself here because I need to, it's a relatively small novel, 250 pages, but it's power packed with so much. And there's history in here, not a lot, but enough to remind us that this is not a story happening just in 1969 or even in 2022. It's a story that has been happening. It's always ever present. How did you do your research? What informed your reach back into history to help, frame the story?
I write academic research-based articles, and then I also do the fiction. And so some of the research that emerged in this book came through the research that I was conducting for some academic work that I was doing around MMIW issues.
Yep.
But actually, I feel like I would identify the bulk of the quote unquote research for this book, I would perhaps call intuitive research. Like I would just turn on the TV and there would be what I needed, for the book right there on PBS or whatever. I'd have a hole in the story, and all I knew about that hole was that it was a Finnish family. And I would just start Googling and all this information would come, and I'd be like, wow, that's a perfect fit for this book. So it was a very interesting process. And like I referenced earlier, the dominant culture uses the word creativity to describe, writing.
Yep.
And, perhaps the another word that describes it just as well might be spirituality.
Sure.
I had experiences writing this book. I thought that it was done about 7 years ago. I was just about to hit the send button to my publisher, and this character came that had not been in my consciousness, I didn't know anything about him. And his whole story, it was downloaded, into my, typed as fast as I could. I got it down. It was Leonard. And then I sobbed for a week. Wow. I mean, sobbed. I was devastated, just devastated. Wow. So it, you know, who can explain it? Who can explain it? It's a mystery, and that it's nice to have mysteries in our lives, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. Thank you for sharing that. Our listeners.
Speaking with Carol Lawrence, author of Cleopatra's Dagger. Are you there, Carol?
I am. I have to say, listening to your calendar of events, I wish I were in Minnesota and could come to some of them.
We do a lot of them, don't we?
Oh, man, it just sounds so fun.
Well, why don't we have some fun and start with a brief description of the book and a reading?
Okay, sure. So I was sort of wondering whether I should take the description from the, listing on Amazon. And I thought it'd be better to use my own words and tell you what, you know, the way I would describe it. Elizabeth Vandenbroek is from an old, pretty well-born Dutch family in New York City in the late 19th century. The year is 1880. And she has a mother who's a terrible social climber and extremely interested in status and really wants to become part of Mrs. Astor's renowned circle of people. And her father is a judge. But Elizabeth has ambitions to be a journalist. And she is, in fact, hired to work for the social column at the New York Herald, which was one of the most popular newspapers in the city in 1880. But she has higher ambitions. She wants to work the crime beat. Mm-hmm. And when she comes across a body in Central Park, she takes that story to her editor, since she discovers the body, and she basically bribes him into letting her take over the crime beat and investigate the murder of someone who was found in Central Park. And that's how she becomes the first female crime reporter in New York City.
Okay, and why don't we do the reading?
Okay, fine. So Elizabeth makes a friend early on in this story who, an artist, she lives in a building that has the fifth floor. This is a real building that actually existed. And she has a young woman who is an artist who introduces herself because she has a studio on the fifth floor of Elizabeth's apartment building. Her name is Carlotta Ackerman. And she's from a Polish Jewish family. And she and Elizabeth, she talks Elizabeth into going, getting up really early in the morning at basically before dawn and meeting her in Central Park just to wander around and eat bagels, which Elizabeth has never had before. And so she brings her little dog, Toby, who goes everywhere with her. And this is the two women together in Central Park very early in the morning where they pretty much have the park to themselves. Chewing on the bagel, Elizabeth followed Carlotta along the south side of the museum and into the park. The dew on the grass sparkled like tiny diamonds in the morning sun, and birdsong filled the air. Her dark thoughts of the night before evaporated with the mist rising from the meadows as they wandered deeper into the park. "Toby loves it here," Carlotta said as the dog dashed about, poking his nose into bushes, hedges, and burrows. "What's that?" she asked as they approached a construction area behind the museum, mountains of excavated dirt stacked in neat piles. "Are they expanding the museum?" "Oh, this must be the site for the obelisk," Elizabeth said. "Obelisk? Have you not heard of Cleopatra's Needle?" "I might have read something about it," Carlotta said airily as Toby charged off to investigate the tempting mounds of dirt. "It's an ancient Egyptian obelisk," Elizabeth said. "There's one in Paris, and London got one 3 years ago, and now we are getting one." "Why?" "From what I've read, it's a gesture of gratitude from Cairo." "I wonder if it's cursed," Carlotta said. "That's going to be a massive hole," she added as they approached. The area was cordoned off by a simple fence made from red rope wound around wooden stakes pushed into the ground. "I doubt that rope really deters anyone," Elizabeth mused as they surveyed the construction site. The hole was still rather shallow, perhaps 6 feet deep, but the bottom lay in deep shadow, invisible from the slanted rays of the morning sun. As they walked around to the other side, Toby began barking furiously from behind a mound of dirt. "Toby!" Carlotta called out, but he ignored her. His barking grew louder and more insistent, interspersed with growls. "Toby, what on earth?" she said, following him. As she stepped behind a pile of dirt, the dog suddenly went silent. Elizabeth heard a squeal of surprise from Carlotta, then what sounded like a body falling to the ground. "Carlotta! Carlotta!" Elizabeth yelled, but there was no reply. Panicked, she dashed to the other side of the pile of dirt and saw Carlotta on the ground in what appeared to be a dead faint. Toby stood over her, looking her face frantically. As Elizabeth knelt down beside her, something at the bottom of the hole caught her eye. Shielding her eyes from the sun, she peered down at the object, now visible from this angle. Her breath caught in her throat when she saw what it was. Her first reaction was that she must be hallucinating, but she realized that Carlotta and Toby had seen it too. Lying at the bottom of the newly dug hole, wrapped in clean white cloth, was what appeared to be a perfectly pristine Egyptian mummy. "So you see it too," Carlotta said, sitting up and brushing the grass from her hair. "It's not a mirage." "Not unless we're both hallucinating," Elizabeth said, helping her to her feet. "Are you quite all right?" "I just fainted. It's nothing. You should take care. I'm perfectly fine, I tell you. You may have some underlying condition. Please refrain from continuing this inquiry. We have something much more pressing to contend with." Toby looked up expectantly, wagging his stump of a tail eagerly. "It looks like a woman," said Carlotta. "Do you suppose it's real?" "It's probably a practical joke," Elizabeth said, dropping to her knees beside the hole. "But there's only one way to find out. Give me a hand." "No, no, you're not. No, you can't." "I can and I will. But surely we should inform police." "And so we shall. But first, I'd like to take a closer look. You don't really believe there's body in there, do you?" "If there is, it's a story my editor cannot afford to refuse. Hand, please." Carlotta helped her down into the hole, which was surprisingly cold and damp, like the grave. Elizabeth shivered as she stepped toward the still white figure. Her conviction was that it was a practical joke faded as she approached. The closer she got, the more it looked like an actual body. "Be careful," Carlotta called down. "It might carry any manner of diseases." Elizabeth looked back up as Toby started barking again. Carlotta grabbed hold of his collar. "Be quiet, Toby." The terrier obeyed, perching at her side obediently, but his body strained forward eagerly. Elizabeth swallowed hard and leaned over the motionless figure. She half expected it to abruptly come to life and thought that if it did, she too would faint. Bending over, she hesitantly touched its shoulder. It was stone cold. No warmth of life coursed through its still limbs, but she realized at once something she had not allowed herself to believe. She was in the presence of a recently deceased person. It was also clear that the body was that of a woman.
Thank you. That was a reading by Carol Lawrence from Cleopatra's Dagger. Let's start with the basic thing. 1880, New York City. I'm wondering, what about that time? And, well, I imagine I know why the city inspired you, but what about the time inspired the book?
Well, I actually had my previous series took place in 1880 in Edinburgh. Mm. And which is a time period that I chose very specifically because a certain person was at medical school at the University of Edinburgh at that time. A certain person who later became famous as the author of the Sherlock Holmes novels. But I was very attracted to the 19th century. And so rather than change time periods and become familiar with a whole other time period, I thought it would be good to stay in the 19th century. And 1880 was actually an amazing year in New York City as well. And so rather than go back to Edinburgh and start a new series in Edinburgh, I thought it would be fun to write about the city that I lived in and knew so well.
Tell us a little bit more about Elizabeth Vanderbroek. I'm wondering especially about her relationship with her family and her desire to break away from that relationship to some extent.
Well, she's of an age and of a time period. You know, it wasn't unusual for well-born young women to go to college. She went to Vassar, which was already a very well-established women's college at the time. And she is straining at the yoke of what is expected of women in that time period. And it was a time period in which there was a lot of social upheaval and social change following the Civil War. There were tremendous changes in society, both in the working class and in the upper classes. And she also observes the incredible poverty and social injustice that existed in New York at the time. And if we think it's bad now, it was almost unbelievable the way the lower classes lived in New York City in 1880. Jacob Riis had yet not come along and began to photograph and document all of these things, but Elizabeth was aware of it, and you couldn't not be aware of it. And so she comes from a family with money and with a certain prestige, and, you know, the Dutch were still considered the aristocracy. The old Dutch families were certainly aristocracy in New York at the time. But she just is not of a mind to just play the game. And her mother's insistence on craving, social, advancement rubs her the wrong way, as so many young people rebel against their parents. So that's not so unusual. So that's kind of what drives her. And she has her literary heroes, and she wants to make a difference, and she wants to break out of the mold.
She gets a job at the Herald, New York Herald. And how does that start for her? Before she becomes a crime writer, she does some other stuff that is not as much interest or fun for her.
Well, her father's a very well-known judge, very respected judge downtown, and you know, the court system it was downtown then, and it still is today. And he works in a building which is still there, right behind City Hall in downtown Manhattan. And so he pulls a few strings. He knows people. He knows the publisher, a very colorful guy called James Gordon Bennett Jr. And he pulls a few strings with Bennett and says, you know, my daughter would really like this job. But the only thing that they can really think of to do with her is to put her on the society page. So she goes to a party at Mrs. Astor's house and, you know, pals around with countesses and viscounts and, you know, people who care about dresses and carriages and jewelry and, you know, fine food and wine. And she thinks that this is all just ridiculous. So that's how she starts out, because that's all she can get, you know, at the beginning.
Now she finds this body and she wants to write the story. How does that come about? How does she get the, not permission, but how does she get the assignment to write the story?
Well, she goes to her editor and she basically lays it on the line. She says, look, I've got this story. And she has to actually go to another editor because her editor, the society page, is not the right person. So she insists on being taken to the crime editor, very colorful Scottish fellow. And she says, look, I've got the inside scoop on this story. And it just so happens since she and Carlotta reported the story to the police, she knows more. Nobody knows anything about it at this point. It's completely, it wasn't, they didn't have Twitter back then, and there weren't any cell phones, and there weren't people running around taking selfies. Oh, here's me with the corpse in Central Park, you know? So stories didn't emerge immediately then the way they do now. So the only people who know about it at this early morning, weekday morning, is Elizabeth, Carlotta, and the police on the Upper East Side precinct that she calls in to, report what she is pretty sure is a crime. And so she's got this incredible inside scoop, and she goes to the police station, you know, and she knows she meets the police detective, you know, who's going to be looking into it. And so she's got all of this insider information, including the only person to see the body in its original, you know, state. And so she says to her editor, "Hey, I got this story, but, you know, guess what? I want to cover it. And otherwise, you know, any other paper could scoop us." And in those days, it was a huge thing getting scooped by another paper. Again, you know, it feels like today everything just comes out all at once, you know. It's right. On Twitter. It's on Facebook. It's on, you know, CNN. Oh, look. But in those days, it was, you know, reporters roamed the city trying to be the first one to report on a story. So that's how she ends up with it. Her editor realizes he's got very little choice if he wants, you know, a prime spot in the story. So he gives it to her with reservations, but well, he does it.
She encounters a great deal of sexism as she's trying to do this story. Why don't you talk some about that?
Well, again, you know, it's you know, the term toxic masculinity was not in the lexicon. And, you know, women were really had yet to break out of the roles that they had been assigned, which was some version of Kirche, Küche, Kinder, you know, which is church, kitchen, children. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was what was expected. Even high born women, you know, they could do without the kitchen. Sure, they didn't have to work in the kitchen, but, you know, they were expected to have children and go to church and all the rest of it. So Elizabeth, you know, just doesn't see herself that way, but she has to deal with it nonetheless.
You must have done an awful lot of research to do this, both about 1880 New York City, and also Egyptian mythology comes into the book quite a bit. Talk about the ways that you did the research and how that all came about.
Well, the great thing about New York, I mean, it's a two-edged sword, because I had researched Edinburgh, which is a city I know, but not a city I live in, obviously. And I thought, well, you know, I'll be able to do similar research in New York. And it was like going down a rabbit hole. It's amazing. The history of the city is just so wide and so deep. And almost from the beginning, it was so important to the history of this country. And, you know, it was just, it's vast and it's amazing. And so my job was deeper and wider than I ever thought. And the fact that I live here didn't really help all that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it meant I could prowl the streets and look for old buildings and, you know, but I still had to read and read and read. But what's great is that there's so much out there. There are so many fabulous websites and books and blogs and just, it's terrific. Their Facebook page, there's an entire Facebook page that's just devoted to photographs of old New York. And there's also some places where you can actually see, you know, early films in the city. There's one amazing trip that you can take, actually riding the entire length of the L, the Second Avenue L, which figures pretty prominently in my story. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a great joy to like collect books and go to blogs and, you know, go to all these different websites, and you could do it for the rest of your life and still not know everything that there is to know. So I figure if this writing thing doesn't work out, I'll just teach New York history on the side.
And you knew a lot, or you bring out a lot about the neighborhoods in New York and the different levels of crime and goodness and difficulty about living in New York at that time. Talk about the neighborhoods to some extent.
Well, I was delighted to find, I've been living in the East Village for years now, for nearly half my life now I've been living in the East Village, and I love it here. And I knew that we had a history of resistance and a history of leftists and anarchists. And I knew all of this because even when I moved here, there were still anarchists living here. And, you know, and there still kind of are in a way, you know, it's always been a funky lefty, you know, place to live. But I didn't realize the depth of what actually happened here. And some of the buildings are still in existence. I didn't know much about the Tompkins Square riots. And of course, you know, Abraham Lincoln gave the famous address. I knew this, but I did more research into it, at Cooper Union, which is in my neighborhood, which is at Astor Place, basically. Abraham Lincoln gave an address which was widely credited with helping to land him the nomination of the Republican Party when he was elected as president. And that took place just, maybe half a mile from me. Mm-hmm. And just layers and layers of things like this kept coming up. You know, the German history of my neighborhood. My neighborhood was part of what was known as Klein Deutschland. Just a few blocks from me, Emma Goldman and Ambrose Bierce. Wow. Hung out at a saloon, which is still in, which the building is still there, and there's a plaque in front of it, and you can still go into the room where the saloon was held. And a guy by the name of Justus Schwab was the saloon keeper, and famously ran through Tompkins Square waving a flag during the famous riots, you know, protesting the police brutality coming down on the rioters, which, you know, is a whole story into itself. They were given permission, but then the permission was taken away at the last minute, and consequently the police just came in and pummeled them for no reason. You know, I guess things don't change that much. But just things like that. Now when I go outside, I have such an appreciation of where I live, and I have such pride in its history and what took place here and the people who lived here. I mean, it's thrilling to think of Emma Goldman, you know, smoking her cigar just about a quarter of a mile from my front door.
Mrs. Astor, I know, is based on a real person. I'm wondering which of the characters are based on historical figures and which sprang a whole cloth from your imagination.
Well, Mrs. Astor, of course, is Mrs. Astor herself. I hope her family, living family members don't sue me. I don't think they will. She comes across pretty well, I think. So Mrs. Astor is real. Her son Jack is real. Also real is Justus Schwab himself, the saloon keeper that I talked about. Also, Thomas Burns, who was the chief of detectives, had just been appointed, and who, interestingly to me, I forgot about this. I enjoyed Caleb Carr's The Alienist a lot when I read it.
Oh, yeah.
And then I saw the, you know, series that they did. I forgot that Thomas Burns figured prominently in his story, too. He was played by the wonderful Ted Levine, who has the distinction of having played Buffalo Bill in The Silence of the Lambs, and then played Monk's boss on the Monk series, and then later on played Thomas Burns in the Alienist. So he's got quite a career as a serial killer, you know, policeman, and chief of detectives. So so Burns is definitely also a character in my story, and I don't treat him any better than Caleb Carr did. I see him as a bit of a thug. He's the guy who originated the term the third degree, because he thought nothing of pummeling a suspect into a confession. And of course, in those days, there were no security cams to catch that. So, you know, it was pretty common, but Burns was a complicated figure. He was a great groundbreaker and an innovator for sure, but he was also quite a thug. And he was also, you know, part of the Tammany Hall corruption, which continued well after Boss Tweed died. I mean, the corruption of Tammany Hall didn't end when Boss Tweed left the earth. It continued on.
Well, we only have a couple more minutes, unfortunately, so I would like you to, hopefully this is not a spoiler, but I was wondering if this is going to be a series.
Well, you know, I wish I could answer that. I would very much like it to be a series. But that's, and I've left all kinds of little backstory tidbits sort of hanging. So there's some unanswered mysteries. You know, Elizabeth is attacked at one point and we never learn the identity of her attacker. I was leaving that for a later book. But it's kind of up to my publisher as to what their next move is. So I'm fingers crossed. I'd like to continue. I certainly have ideas for what the next story might be.
And what else are you working on in the next little while here?
Well, my play that I wrote about physics, about quantum physics, actually, is has been optioned for an off-Broadway production in New York, and that's scheduled at this point to open on August 22nd. So, you know, I'll be in rehearsals for that, you know, tweaking the script and, you know, hopefully helping to get it on its feet. And so I just found out about that a little while ago. And, you know, one has to keep one's hand in. So if I don't immediately start work on a novel, I'll probably just, I've been studying poetry and I know I've written and been published and won some awards, but, you know, I feel like there's room for improvement and I haven't, you know, I feel it's good to study. And so I'm reading a couple of really terrific books about the writing of poetry now. One is by Mary Oliver. And so I'll probably be working on some new poems.
Well, thank you so much, Carol. We've been speaking to Carol Lawrence, author of the wonderful book Cleopatra's Dagger, taking place in 1880 and New York City. We appreciate you being with us tonight on Ray and on Radio, and thank you so much for a wonderful interview.
Thank you so much, Liz. It was a great pleasure, and you all take care and stay warm up there in chilly northern Minnesota.
Minnesota. Yes. That's right.
Minnesota. Yeah,
okay.
You take care up there, eh?
Yes, you betcha.
Don't let those Canadians come down and tell you what to do, eh?
No, eh? Okay, thanks a lot, Carol. We really appreciate you.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Chris Stark and Carol Lawrence, and all our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You are listening right now to Right on Radio. You can find more news and info at Right on Radio, KFAI.org/Right on Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and so on.